Chapter 14. There I stood. Behind me the semicircle of the crew seemed to recoil from the man and from Mr. Hollybrass, who appeared not far behind.
"Miss Doyle," the captain said with barely suppressed fury, "what is the meaning of this?"
I stood mute. How could I explain to him? Besides, there were no words left within me. I had gone through too many transformations of mood and spirit within the last 24 hours. When I remained silent, he demanded,
"Why are you dressed in this scandalous fashion? Answer me!"
The angrier he became, the darker grew the color of the welt on his face.
"Who gave you permission to climb into the rigging?"
I backed up a step and said, I've joined the crew." Unable to comprehend my words, Captain Jaggery remained staring fixedly at me. Then gradually he did understand. His face flushed red, his fists clenched.
"Miss Doyle," he said between gritted teeth, "you will go to your cabin, remove these obscene garments, and put on your proper dress. You are causing a disruption. I will not allow it."
But when I continued to stand there, unmoving, making no response, he suddenly shouted,
"Did you not hear me? Get to your cabin."
"I won't," I blurted out. "I'm no longer a passenger. I'm with them." So saying, I stepped back until I sensed the men around me. The captain glared at the crew.
"And you," he sneered. "I suppose you'd have her."
The response of the men was silence. The captain seemed unsure what to do.
"Mr. Hollybrass,"
he barked finally.
"Waiting your orders, sir."
The captain flushed again. He shifted his attention back to me.
"Your father, Miss Doyle," he declared. "He would not allow this."
"I think I know my father, an officer in the company who owns this ship, and your employer, better than you," I said. "He would approve of my reasons." The captain's uncertainty grew. At last he replied,
"Very well, Miss Doyle. If you do not assume your proper attire this instant, if you insist upon playing these games, you shall not be given the opportunity to change your mind. If crew you are, crew you shall remain. I promise I shall drive you as I choose."
"I don't care what you do," I threw back at him. The captain turned to the first mate.
"Mr. Hollybrass, remove Miss Doyle's belongings from her cabin. Let her take her place in the forecastle with the crew. Put her down as Mr. Doyle, and list Miss Doyle in the log as lost. From this point on, I expect to see that he works with the rest."
With that, he disappeared into the steerage. No sooner had he done so than the crew, though not Mr. Hollybrass, let out another raucous cheer. In just such a fashion did I become a full-fledged crew member of the Seahawk. Whatever grievous errors I had made before, in thwarting the mutiny led by Cranick and in causing the resulting cruelty toward Zachariah, the sailors appeared to accept my change of heart and position without reservation. They saw my desire to become a crew member not only as atonement, but as a stinging rebuff to Captain Jaggery. Once I had showed myself willing to do what they did, by climbing the rigging, once they saw me stand up to Jaggery, an intense apprenticeship commenced. And for it, the crewmen became my teachers. They helped me, worked with me, guided me past the mortal dangers that lurked in every task. In this, they were far more patient with all my repeated errors than those teachers at the Barrington School for Better Girls, when there was nothing to learn but penmanship, spelling, and the ancient authors of morality. You may believe me, too, when I say that I shirked no work. Even if I'd wanted to, it was clear from the start that shirking would not be allowed. I pounded oakum into the deck. I scraped the hull.
I stood watch as dawn blessed the sea and as the moon cut the midnight sky. I tossed the line to measure the depths of the sea. I took my turn at the wheel. I swabbed the deck and tarred the rigging, spliced ropes and tied knots. My mess was shared with the crew, and I went aloft. Indeed, that first journey to the top of the mainmast was but the prelude to many daily climbs. Of course, after that first, there were always others who went along with me. High above the sea, my crewmates taught me to work with one hand, the other must hold on, to dangle over spars, to reef sails, to edge along the walk ropes. So I came to work every sail, at every hour of the day. As for the captain, he was as good as his word. No, better than his word. He continued to drive his crew without mercy, and since I was now a part of it, he drove them, and me in particular, harder than before. But try as he might, he could find no cause for complaint. I would not let him. My knowledge of physical labor had been all but nil, of course. Hardly a wonder, then, that from the moment I joined the crew, I was in pain. I ached as if my body had been racked. My skin turned pink, then red, then brown. The flesh upon my hands broke first into oozing, running sores, then metamorphosed into a new, rough hide, all as promised. And when my watch was done, I flung myself into my hammock and slept the sleep of righteousness, though never more than 4 hours, and more often less. A word must be said about where and how I slept. It will be remembered that the captain denied me my cabin, insisting that I take my place in the forecastle with the men. No doubt he thought to humiliate me and force me to return to my former place. The men caucused that first day, and in a meeting that concluded with a sacred oath, bade me take my place along with them, swearing to give me the utmost privacy they could provide. They would be my brothers. I was no longer to be called Miss Doyle, but Charlotte. I was given a hammock placed in a corner. Around this, a piece of torn sail was tacked up as a kind of curtain. The space was private for me, and kept that way. True, I heard and learned their rough language. I confess, too, that in my newfound freedom I brandished a few bold terms of my own, to the amusement of the men at first. But after a while it became rather second nature to me, and to them. I say this not to brag, but to suggest the complete absorption I felt in my new life. I came to feel a sense of exhilaration in it, such as I had never felt before. Thus it was that after a fortnight I found myself atop the foremast, hugging the topgallant spar, my bare brown feet nimbly balancing on the foot ropes. It was 7 bells of the second dog watch, just before dusk. The wind was out of the northwest. Our sails were taut. Our studding sails were set. Below, the ship's bow, as though pulled by her winged figurehead, plunged repeatedly, stirring froth and foam. This rocking movement seemed effortless to me now, as if, like the ship's namesake, we were flying. Not far off our starboard bow, dolphins chased the waves, flyers themselves. My hair, uncombed for days, blew free in the salty air. My face, dark with weather, was creased with smile. I was squinting westward into the swollen face of a blood-red sun, which cast a shimmering golden road upon the sea. From where I perched, it seemed we were sailing on that road in a dream. And there I was, joyous, new-made, liberated from a prison I'd thought was my proper place. The only shadow on my happiness was Captain Jaggery. He came on deck infrequently, and when he did, he was enveloped in the murkiest gloom. Rarely did he speak to anyone but the mates, Mr. Hollabrass and Mr. Johnson now, and only then to give orders or rebukes. Naturally, the captain was the principal subject of endless scuttlebutt in the forecastle during off-watch times. Ewing claimed there was tension between the captain and the first mate because Mr. Hollybrass didn't approve of Jaggery's ways.
"Don't you believe it,"
said Keach, who, if anything, had grown more tense since his demotion.
"Hollybrass is gloved to Jaggery's hand."
Fisk insisted Jaggery's keeping below so much was only a case of his wanting to hide the welt on his face, of hiding himself in shame. It was Grimes who swore he was pressing us to make a crossing in good time, and so prove he'd done no wrong. But it was Foley who said that I was the cause of the captain's every move. "What do you mean?" I demanded.
"I've seen him," Foley insisted. "Studied him. He doesn't come out unless it's your watch. One eye keeps the ship in trim, but the other..."
"What?" I said, sensing already that he was right.
"He's always watching you,"
Foley said, looking around at the others for confirmation.
"And there's nothing but hatred in his eye."
The others nodded in agreement. "But why?" I asked.
"He's waiting, wanting you to make a mistake," Morgan put in, taking a deep pull on his pipe, then filling the forecastle with its acrid smoke.
"What kind of mistake?" I asked.
"Something he can use against you. Something to set him right. Look here, Charlotte, you boxed him in."
"I did?"
"It was that first moment you joined us. You mentioned your father, didn't you? Said he'd approve of what you've done?"
"He would. He believes in justice."
"Be that as it may, Jaggery didn't know what to do. He gave way. Not a thing he likes, you know. So now I say he's waiting for a mistake on your part to set himself back up."
"I don't intend to make a mistake," I stated proudly. Fisk spat upon the floor.
"Neither does he."
It came to pass as Morgan promised. To a person on land, the sight of a ship's sails, bleached by sun, stretched by wind, is the very image of airy lightness. In fact, a sail is made of very heavy canvas. When one gets tangled on a spar, it must be pulled loose quickly, or it can tear or burst, and in so doing, pull down rigging, spars, even a mast. A sail out of control can flick like a wild whip and send a full-grown sailor into a senseless spin. It often happens. Now the flying jib is set at the furthest point of the bowsprit, at the very tip of it. When you consider that the bow of a speeding ship on a high sea forever rises and falls, you will perceive that a broken jib can dip into the sea itself. Such is the water's force, and the driving of the ship, that the bowsprit itself can be caused to snap. Thus, the sailor who seeks to repair a tangled jib must contend not only with a heavy, flailing sail, but the powerful, rushing sea only a few feet, sometimes closer, below him. One afternoon, 2 days after our forecastle talk and during my watch, the flying jib became entangled in just the way I have described. As soon as he saw it, Captain Jaggery cried,
"Mr. Doyle, fix the bowsprit."
In his haste to call on me, he spoke directly, not through one of his mates. Before I could respond, Grimes leaped forward, calling,
"I'll do it, sir."
Grimes was one of the bearded ones, quick to flare, quick to forget.
"The call was for Mr. Doyle," returned the captain. "Does he refuse?"
"No, sir," I said, and hurried to the knighthead from which the bowsprit thrust forward. Grimes hurried along with me, offering hasty instructions in my ear, as well as urging a splicing knife upon me. I took it and put it in a pocket.
"Charlotte, do you see that line out there?" he asked,
pointing to the twisted line at the far end of the bowsprit that had snarled the jib. I nodded.
"Don't monkey with the sail itself. All you need do is cut the rope. The sail will free itself, and we've got others. Mind, you'll need to cut sharp. Then swing down under the bowsprit in one quick jump, or the sail will toss you in. Understand?"
Again I nodded.
Time yourself proper. If the ship plunges, the sea will up and grab you.
So cocky had I become that I leaped to the headrail with little thought or worry, then set my foot upon the bowsprit itself. I saw that I needed to walk out along this bowsprit some 20 feet. Not too difficult a task, I thought, because the back rope was something I could cling to. As I had by now learned to do, I started off by keeping my eyes on the bowsprit and my bare feet, inching step by step along it. The hiss of the water rushing below was pronounced. The bowsprit itself, wet and slippery with foam. No matter. What took me by surprise was the bowsprit's wild bobbing. Halfway along, I glanced back. For the first time since I'd boarded the ship, I saw the figurehead clearly. The pale white seahawk with wings thrust back against the bow, its head extended forward, beak open wide in a scream. As the bow dipped, this open beak dropped and dropped again into the sea, coming up each time with foam streaming like a rabid dog. So startled was I by the frightful vision that for a moment I froze until a sudden plunge of the ship almost tumbled me seaward. I reached the crucial point soon enough, but only by curling my toes tight upon the bowsprit, and holding fast onto the back rope line with one hand was I able to free the other to take Grimes's splicing knife from my pocket. I leaned forward and began to cut. The tightness of the tangled line helped. The knife cut freely. Too much so. The last remaining strand snapped with a crack. The sail boomed out, flicking away at my cutting hand, and the knife went flying into the sea. Even as I lunged for it, the bowsprit plunged. I slipped and started to fall. By merest chance, I made a successful grab at the bowsprit itself, which left me hanging, feet dangling, only a few feet above the rushing sea. As the Seahawk plunged and plunged again, I was dunked to my waist, to my chest. I tried to swing myself up to hook my feet over, but I could not. The sea kept snatching at me, trying to pull me down while I dangled there, kicking wildly, uselessly. Twice my head went under. Blinded, I swallowed water, choked. Then I saw that only by timing my leg swings to the upward thrust of the ship could I save myself. The ship heaved skyward. With all my might, I swung my legs up and wrapped them about the bowsprit. But again the Seahawk plunged. Into the tearing sea I went, clutching the spar. Then up. This time I used the momentum to swing over, so I was now atop the bowsprit, straddling it, then lying on it. Someone must have called to the man at the helm. The ship shifted course, found easier water, slowed, ceased to plunge so. Gasping for breath, spitting seawater, I was able to pull myself along the bowsprit and finally, by stepping on the wooden bird's furious head, climbed over the rail. Grimes was there to help me onto the deck and give me an enthusiastic hug of approval. The captain, of course, watched me stony-faced.
"Mr. Doyle," he barked, "come here."
Though greatly shaken, I had no time to be frightened. I had done the task, and I knew I'd done it. I hurried to the quarter-deck.
"When I ask you to do a job," the captain said, "it's you I ask and not another. You've caused us to change course, to lose time."
And before I could respond, he struck me across the face with the back of his hand, then turned and walked away. My reaction was quick.
"Coward!"
I screamed at him.
"Fraud!"
He spun about and began to stride back toward me, his scarred face contorted in rage. But I, in a rage myself, wouldn't give way.
"I can't wait till Providence," I shouted at him. "I'll go right to the courts. You won't be Captain Long. You'll be seen by everyone as the cruel despot you are."
And I spat upon the deck by his boots. My words made him turn as pale as a ghost with murder in his eye. But then, abruptly, He gained control of himself and, as he'd done on previous occasions, whirled about and left the deck. I turned away, feeling triumphant. Much of the crew had seen it all. But there were no more hurrahs. The moment passed. Nothing more was said, save by Grimes, who insisted that I take lessons in the handling of a knife, carrying it, using it, even throwing it. On my first watch off, he had me practice on the deck for 3 hours. 2 more days passed without incident. In that time, however, the sky turned a perpetual gray. The air thickened with moisture. Winds rose and fell in what I thought was a peculiar pattern. Toward the end of the second day, when Barlow and I were scraping down the capstan, I saw a branch on the waves. A red bird was perched on the branch. "Look!" I cried with delight, pointing to the bird. "Does that mean we're close to land?" Barlow hauled himself up to take a look. He shook his head.
"That bird's from the Caribbean, 1,000 miles off. I've seen them there. Blood bird, they call them."
"What's it doing here?" After a moment he said,
"Storm driven."
I looked at him in surprise. "What kind of a storm would blow a bird that far?" I asked, wide-eyed.
"Hurricane."
"What's a hurricane?"
"The worst storm of all."
"Can't we sail around?" Barlow again glanced at the helm, the sails, and then at the sky above. He frowned.
"I heard Mr. Hollybrass and Jaggery arguing about it. To my understanding," he said, "I don't think the captain wants to avoid it."
"Why not?"
"That's what Grimes has been saying. The captain's trying to move fast. If he sets us right at the hurricane's edge, it'll blow us home like a pound of shot in a 2-pound cannon.
"What if he doesn't get it right?"
2 pounds of shot in a 1-pound cannon.